Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the Roundtable and Webinar on Revised Landscape in India for Foreign Portfolio Investments. This event is being organized by Nishit Desai Associates. The speakers are Kishore Joshi, Head of Regulatory Practice in Nishit Desai Associates, Richie Sancheti, Head of Funds Practice Group in Nishit Desai Associates, Aditya Srinivasan, Senior Member of the Fund Formation Practices in Nishit Desai Associates. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity for you to ask questions at the end of today's discussion. If you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. Also, you can download our mobile applet, Nishit Mobile, which is available on the App Store for iOS device, Play Store for Androids, and BlackBerry World to access the current updates and videos. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand over the session to Mr. Kishore Joshi. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Yeah, thank you. And good evening to all ladies and gentlemen present here physically. And of course, good morning to all the participants from the US and other parts. Let's start with yet another session on the portfolio investment, which I'm Porse and Uriya. As you all know, portfolio investment plays an important role as far as Indian economy is concerned, because for almost 23 years, there has been a lot of portfolio investment that has been happening. There are a lot of changes that have taken place over a period of time. Just to take you through the history of how it all started, of course, you all know that in 1992, the government of India first time introduced portfolio investment regime. And in 1995, of course, SEBI, being the securities regulator, notified FII regulations. And that's how SEBI started monitoring all the portfolio investment by the FIIs. When they introduced this regime, of course, at that time, the FIIs and sub-accounts were the two categories which they used to register with them. Over a period of time, they allowed foreign corporates and foreign individuals as additional categories for investments into India. Yet, of course, they had some reservations as far as foreign corporates and individuals are concerned. So even though they notified it, there were hardly any individuals that were registered. They also allowed FIIs to invest their proprietary funds through the proprietary sub-account route. The portfolio investment, of course, under the SEBI regime has been happening for almost 15 years or so. So it was in 2010 that the government felt a need that since there are these different investment regimes under which the foreign investors have been investing, for example, we have this FII regime separately, NRI is a separate category, we're investing under the NRI portfolio investment scheme. There has been these FVCIs, that's the other category which SEBI had introduced under which foreign investors were investing. So that's where government felt a need that they should try and see if they can kind of rationalize any of these categories, different routes into one. And that's where they formed a working group under the chairmanship of Dr. U.K. Sinha. It was in 2009. In 2010, Dr. Sinha's committee gave a report. There are primarily two, three recommendations, important recommendations that the committee gave. One, of course, is that there should be a separate, altogether new regime called Qualified Financial Investors Regime, which would include of FIIs, FVCIs, as also NRIs, which is what, of course, proposed by them. And the investment under this particular regime should be less than 10%. They actually did kind of a comparative of different countries, and globally they found that a portfolio investment is made up to less than 10%, and anything about that is generally direct investments. And that's where they made a recommendation in that. Of course, neither SEBI or government kind of acted upon it immediately. And in fact, in 2012, SEBI introduced a separate route primarily for foreign individuals called Qualified Foreign Investor route. That's the QFI route that came into effect. in 2013, since again there was a confusion as to whether the individuals would invest only through PFIs, NRIs would invest whether through NRI PIS or through PFI, because NRIs were also allowed to invest through PFI route. And that's where SEBI, in fact, set up a committee under the chairmanship of Chandrasekharan. So Chandrasekharan committee gave its report in 2013 in respect of rationalization of investment routes. They proposed a separate PFI route, again, qualified the portfolio investors route, wherein they indicated that all the FIIs, sub-accounts and QFIs should be brought together. They in fact recommended that NRI PIS route, which initially started by the government and the Reserve Bank of India, should not be touched upon and that should be continued. And of course they introduced risk-based KYC and have recommended for these three categories depending on the risk profile, which report then was taken up by SEBI. And in the 2014, January 7, 2014, they introduced foreign portfolio investor regime. The important, of course, aspects of this FPI regime was that it repealed the earlier FII regulations. Of course, all the FIIs and sub-accounts were grandfathered under the FPI regime so that they could continue to make investments till their registration. The other important aspect was the relationship of the FII and the sub-account, like kind of a sponsored relationship that each sub-account should have an FII. That has been done away with, so all the funds now could be set up independently as FPI under this new regime. The investment limit, of course, was fixed at less than 10% as recommended by the earlier committees. The three categories based on risk profile were introduced, like FPI category 1 for government-related bodies. The category 2 was more for collective investment scheme vehicles or the investment managers, and category 3 that was introduced under the FPI regime importantly was for all the non-regulated or those entities which couldn't fulfill the broad-based criteria, the individuals, the family offices, they could be registered as category 3 of investors. There has been some restrictions initially even from the FII regulations on some of the structures like PCCs and SPCs. SEBI had to a certain extent liberalized these kind of opaque structures subject to fulfillment of certain conditions. So to that extent, if any of the government of any country has imposed that the fund has to be a PCC or a SPC, and so far as it fulfills certain conditions, SEBI has started accepting them as the FPIs. The broad-based criteria was tweaked a little bit to that extent. What SEBI has indicated that even if you have an institutional investor into your fund, you have to have at least 20 investors. So they have done away with that less than 20 investor criteria. Of course, SEBI has still seems not come out with what exactly is the institutional investor means. So they haven't come out with either a definition or a clarification. The last, of course, is the ODI eligibility criteria, which too they have tweaked, because under the FII regulations, even if an ODI, which is unregulated, could subscribe to the ODIs provided its investment manager was appropriately regulated. Under the FPI regulations, of course, they said that each and every ODI subscriber has to be a regulated entity. Of course, maybe we will get more into this primarily because SEBI has recently introduced a circular on the ODIs, putting certain restrictions, adding certain criteria. So let's try to understand that more in detail. So maybe may I request Richie, if you can just briefly touch upon as to what is an ODI and who can issue and subscribe these ODIs.
Thanks, Ashur. I think just to take a cue to begin with, what is understood as an ODI in an Indian context? So an ODI is an offshore derivative instrument, which is an instrument of which can take any kind. It could be a total return swap. It could be a contractual counterparty sort of arrangement. It could be a P-note, again, which is reportable to SEBI. As long as this instrument is something which is issued overseas by a foreign portfolio investor, earlier it was FII, now it has been led to FPIs, foreign portfolio investors. So as long as it is an instrument issued overseas by a foreign portfolio investor against securities held by it, so it has to be on a pure 1:1 hedge basis. It can't be like, you know, you issue ODIs, but at the hedge position, you are on an unhedged basis. So if, as long as there is a hedged basis of the underlying securities, and these are securities which are listed or proposed to be listed on the floor of the stock exchange or some recognized stock exchange in India, it qualifies as a reportable P-note from SEBI's perspective. Now, the interesting piece here is that the securities could be pure play equity instruments. It could be units of a mutual fund. If, let's say, an FPI were to subscribe to units of a mutual fund, they could in turn issue on top of it ODI instruments. It could also be listed debentures, like non-convertible debentures, which are in vogue currently. So the underlying instrument could be any of the securities. As long as an FPI holds that and issues a tracking instrument on top of it, it should qualify as a reportable P-note. I think where the complication started arising was when SEBI for the first time introduced in the FPI regulations the concept that to be an eligible subscriber of an ODI, you have to be regulated by an appropriate regulatory authority. Now, unlike the old regulations under the FI regime, where regulation 15A clearly identified who the appropriate regulatory authorities were, the reference there at that point in time was a securities regulator, a banking regulator, or a futures regulator also. Unlike that, the FPI regime under Regulation 22 does not identify which are the appropriate regulators. It is in this respect that SEBI came out with a clarification in the format of FAQs, which SEBI has been releasing, you know, at different terms, where they said that to understand which is an appropriate financial, appropriate securities regulator or an appropriate regulator for an ODI subscriber, they referred back to Regulation 51B. And the reason why I'm doing this cross-referencing between regulations is because what had happened is 51B sort of puts out which is, you know, an appropriate regulator and what qualifies as an appropriately regulated entity. So what had happened is, you know, suddenly ODI issuers started taking a view that, okay, to be an eligible subscriber to an ODI, do you have to be an appropriately regulated by an appropriate regulatory authority, or is it only regulated by an appropriate regulatory authority? The reason the distinction becomes very critical is because SEBI in another FAQ also came out with a view that it did not perceive an investment holding company set out in Mauritius, which even though it is regulated by FSC, the securities regulator in Mauritius, it in SEBI's view is not appropriately regulated. So that is why some you know, issuers or some intermediaries started taking a view that, okay, if is an investment holding company no longer a right entity to subscribe to ODI? The mischief actually gets slightly elongated because when you get into the zone of where, okay, is an entity which is already regulated, no dispute about it, is it appropriately regulated or not, there are no precise thresholds or standards. So suddenly an entity which is, let's say, regulated by SEMA in Cayman Islands, you would take the comfort that, okay, this is regulated and its name is there in the registers, etc. But then again, the second view would need to be taken, okay, is it appropriately regulated or not? So this, we believe, is slightly a view which is more conservative than what the regulator may have opted for. Having said that, there is a basis for each view being taken. I think the entire color of this issue is yet to pan out. We are yet to see what more views SEBI or the, you know, intermediaries come out with. This clearly hampers the market. You suddenly are reducing the universe of eligible entities which can subscribe to ODI, even though they were under the previous regime eligible to subscribe to ODI. So I think this was one of the issues which has been vexing the market as far as subscribers to ODI contracts are concerned.
Sure. Thank you, Richie. Let's hope that, you know, when SEBI refers in Regulation 22 to, or rather in the FAQs to refer to 51B, what they meant was only the appropriate foreign regulatory authority, and that you should not jump up and see that even the regulated entity should also be then regarded as appropriately regulated, importantly for the purpose of ODI subscriptions. And I hope they clarify that to that effect. Aditya, you want to add anything to this? Or maybe if are there any implications of this SEBI circular?
Yeah, I think sure. So two very brief comments over here on, you know, the entities that are eligible to subscribe to ODIs. First, of course, is that under the erstwhile FII regulations, under the erstwhile FII regime, an ODI subscriber did not necessarily have to be regulated in its own right or regulated independently in order to subscribe to ODIs. and it was possible for a broad-based fund, which is unregulated, to subscribe to ODIs as long as its investment manager was a regulated entity. Now, this class of entity has been completely taken off the books as far as the FPI regulations are concerned. With, however, you know, one little clarification that SEBI has given in question 72 of the FAQ that it released, that an existing ODI subscriber, that is as of January 7, 2014, such an ODI subscriber could continue to subscribe to ODIs even if it wasn't regulated itself, as long as its investment manager, previous investment manager and future investment managers are regulated. I think from an implications perspective, and you know, probably Richie and Kishore, you yourself can also talk about this at length. One of the things that's happened is that I think SEBI has really clamped down on allowing entities that are not regulated by it to take exposure to the Indian public markets, and that's probably one of the reasons why it's you know, even come out with a circular which we'll talk about at length subsequently. I think the other real implication is that, as Richie also mentioned, the universe of ODI subscribers has been reduced significantly as compared to the erstwhile FII regulation. And I think this further sort of elucidates SEBI's intention with respect to whether it wants people to participate in the form of notes or not.
Sure, that's true. It seems that this ODI circular seems to be SEBI sending some kind of messages that maybe you try to come directly instead of through ODIs or so. There are, of course, other implications which come out from this particular SEBI circular. One, of course, is on the clubbing of investment limits, which earlier was restricted only to the FPI direct investments through ODIs, even if the same investors, the same beneficial owners could make investments indirectly through ODIs without any limits. So maybe, Richie, if you can just explain what exactly this SEBI circular talks about it.
Sure. So I think this is one clear big departure from the previous regime, where investors who could take exposures through direct participation as an FI or sub-account, and on the other hand, they could also take exposures either the same entity or within the slightly larger group level, they could take exposure through ODI route. This, of course, for several reasons could have been done to augment their position. Maybe for certain reasons, a different group entity subscribing to ODI, maybe the appetite for India risk was not for direct participation, but through a counterparty sort of relationship, where you don't hold rupee-denominated assets, but a contractual note which may be dollar-denominated on the cash flow side. So for several reasons, you know, and this has been a development which has been sort of witnessed in more mature markets like in US, where, you know, for several reasons, including breach of takeover code or breach of reporting norms, what, you know, SEC in US had also done in 2008-09, they came out with the view that, okay, if you take exposures directly through the direct investment route, and if you also take exposures through an ODI contract, the nuance in those sort of situations were that an ODI subscriber could actually instruct the ODI issuer on A, not only to pass on the economics of the underlying asset class, but also on how it should vote. For this, to the minds of the regulator like SEC or more other mature jurisdictions, this in their mind sort of put together all the attributes of a beneficial owner. If A, you are tracking the economic ownership and you also have the right on how the, you know, the issuer is going to vote, then in those cases, you know, they sort of club the positions both under the synthetic exposure of an ODI as well as the direct participation that you may already have through your own balance sheet. So this interview sort of triggered the takeover norms, the insider trading regulations, the limits that an investor might have on taking an exposure to an Indian company. On similar lines, you know, you can say that SEBI has introduced this rule that they don't want investors to sort of take exposure through the ODI route to sort of supplement their positions on the direct participation and sort of overcome or breach the 9.99% limits that they've set out for investors. However, I think it's still a phased implementation. You still don't see this sort of a collation of holdings for purposes of other securities laws like takeover code or insider trading, etc. There you still see that clubbing effect still not coming to play, but it could so pan out eventually. The second issue, however, remains more from a fund manager's perspective. Now, if you were to look at who the ODI subscriber is, and the ODI subscriber is giving a representation that, okay, the subscriber or its investors or an investor group do not directly or indirectly are in reach of these 10% position limits, then a manager would have to interact with all other portfolio managers of that particular investor group and sort of take a view that, okay, is any position that that fund is taking in breach of the 10% limit? That is one effect of it. Of course, there are a lot of representations built in this industry. The entire industry works in a basis that, okay, the ODI issuer is taking some of the representations from an ODI subscriber. The ODI subscriber could be a fund or it could be an underlying client. They in turn are giving some representations. So this entire layer of representations ultimately hinges that at some level somebody will have to collate the data on how the entire investments for a particular investor group is being panned out, and the entire thing will have to be then be added. So clearly there are solutions around it. Solutions are something which are slightly pragmatic but not exactly meeting, or there are solutions where an investor will have to give a declaration, but at any point in time the ODI issuer or the regulator can ask for some information where they may have to be in a position where they can demonstrate that they have been in compliance of this sort of a requirement. So this was more on the ODI issuer side. The other issue which has been coming out is on the clubbing and the entire thing that, okay, the clubbing allows a grandfathering to existing ODI contracts. So to take an example, let's say an investor already holds 7 or 8% through the direct investment route of an FPI or a sub-account under the earlier regime. They also have an existing contract which allows them exposure to the same underlying SIP for another 5 to 6%. So together they are, let's say, at 14 or 15%. This, in SEBI's views, is allowed to continue as long as your ODI position is still outstanding. At the date of maturity of the ODI contract or the E-note, you cannot further renew it any further. It has to sort of expire on that given date. So there is this grandfathering provision where you don't have to unwind your positions in a hurried manner. You can continue holding your position, but don't aggravate the situation by taking more positions. Now this can lead to slightly more nuanced situations where, let's say, you hold direct participation to 7 or 8% or a pretty much a sizable amount. And let's say you also hold ODI positions under the same script. If, let's say, the script is not that liquid, how do you sort of liquidate your ODI position? Ultimately, the ODI issuer is tracking the value for you. And the ODI subscriber is, in a way, you know, gaining from the value on the sale prices, etc. So if, let's say, you were to, you know, disband your entire investments, if you were to unwind the ODI positions in a larger lot, it could impact the prices of that script, which in fact could sort of undermine the value on your direct position. So this entire unwinding of a P-node also has to be structured. There are different ways on how you can unwind the position. You can find a seller, you can do a bulk deal or a block deal, or you can do it on the floor of the exchange. There are different mechanisms which can be worked out depending on the commercials and specifics of each case. But like I said, this can lead to slightly more nuanced situations, and we have been advising several clients who have been, you know, sort of facing this situation.
Sure. Thank you, Richie. Aditya, if you want to add anything to this?
Yeah, I think Richie makes a very interesting point when he talks about, you know, the requirement to unwind ODI positions. And the question really arises as to whether expiry of the ODI contract in itself is a fair timeline to thrust upon ODI subscribers. And perhaps what may have made a little more sense is if SEBI had allowed a slightly longer timeline and allowed for ODI subscribers to sort of phase out their positions rather than forcing them to really dispose with or to unwind their positions, as Richie said, at such potentially short intervals.
Sure. Thank you. Maybe turning to the other issue which actually is being faced in the industry, of course, as far as portfolio investment is concerned, and that's the NRI participation per se. Somehow SEBI has not been that too comfortable as far as the NRI participation through FIIs and sub-accord is concerned. Most of the intermediaries must have kind of noticed this over a period of time, primarily because NRIs were traditionally having this separate route of portfolio investment to invest individually. So there have been some kind of hiccups in between wherein SEBI at times had stopped NRIs from allowing to invest through the fund entities, and then subsequently they allowed. Initially, of course, as you all know, there were restrictions on NRIs and OCBs, what is called overseas corporate bodies. That means primarily held up to 60% at least by the NRIs from registering as FIIs and sub-accounts. SEBI removed these restrictions on OCBs in 2007. And that's how at least then they started allowing the fund entities to accept participation by NRIs even to the extent of 100%. With the introduction of this FPI, of course, because of the category 3, which is more kind of a perceived as either unregulated or non-broad-based entity, it seems that SEBI has, again, some reservations as far as NRI participation through Category 3 entities are concerned. We understand that recently SEBI had kind of a meeting with some intermediaries wherein they indicated that they would not like NRI participation into such entities from Category 3 beyond 49%. So maybe to that extent, it's really to be seen how, you know, NRIs should be allowed to come under this particular route. Aditya, would you like to touch upon this recent issue?
Sure. So I don't think SEBI has been very kind to non-resident Indians at all. It was always, of course, SEBI's intention that NRIs could not apply for registration as foreign portfolio investors. That was very clear under the FPI regulations, very clear under previous intents as well. I think the only time they really ever made an exception was under the qualified foreign investors regime, where they allowed an NRI to participate as a QFI, provided that they did not already participate under the portfolio investment scheme, which the RBI had created for them. Now, as you rightly mentioned, I think where the issue really arises today is because of the fact that you have different categories of foreign portfolio investors. You have category 2 foreign portfolio investors, which includes your appropriately regulated broad-based funds, your investment advisors, etc. And this is historically the category that SEBI has been comfortable with, because they've seen them in the format of FIs and sub-accounts, and they're okay with NRI participation in that. However, when we move towards this new category, category 3, SEBI appears to not be very comfortable. Although, you know, there's something to be said about the intent of SEBI and how it's sort of evolved over this period of 7 to 8 months, really, since June 1, 2014. You initially had, and when I speak of SEBI's intent, I'm talking specifically in terms of the participation of NRIs as investors in a fund, which does not qualify for a Category 2 FPI registration. So you initially had question 25 of the FPI FAQ, which specifically spoke to whether NRIs could participate in a fund. And at that time, SEBI was very clear. It said that it's perfectly all right to have NRIs as investors in a fund. It was allowed under the erstwhile FII regime. There's no reason why it shouldn't be permitted now. And let's remember that, you know, the first set of 80 FAQs came out together. And along with this question 25 was another question 37, which was a specific question as to, you know, how DDP should assess whether FPIs were funds or pooling vehicles. And there SEBI had specifically said that, you know, one of the things that they should do is to take a declaration. But the other very important thing was to look at whether the FPI applicant had a prospectus or an information memorandum or a private placement memorandum, documents that you would typically associate with a fund or a pooling vehicle. And post this, you had a subsequent set of FAQ which came out. I refer specifically to question 91, in which SEBI had indicated that a company whose majority shareholders were NRIs could not register as an FPI applicant, could not register as an FPI. Category 3 FPI or even a Category 2 FPI, obviously. And it was a result of these three FAQ, really, that a lot of confusion, a lot of issues of interpretation really arose in the industry and among participants in the industry. And for some reason, the issue of whether, you know, a company which had majority NRIs, NRI shareholding, being eligible to register as FPIs, sort of translated into the funds, investment funds context as well. And questions arose as to whether, you know, a Category 3 FPI, which had to register as a Category 3 FPI, probably because it was not a broad-based entity or could not satisfy the broad-based criteria, could have a majority of its investors as NRIs. Now, as you mentioned in your introductory remarks, SEBI had apparently had a meeting with intermediaries where they clarified that a Category 3 FPI could not have its aggregate participation of NRIs of anything more than 49%. And that clearly sort of, while again, we should note over here that none of this is really set out in black and white. None of this is given in writing, even in the form of a clarification. It appears as if SEBI is not comfortable with the idea of the NRI investors in a fund crossing the 49% threshold.
Sure, thank you, Aditya. So it seems that currently NRI is either can come under the NRI portfolio investment route, or they could come under a fund, a pooling vehicle registered as a broad-based FPI. Because I remember initially when this QFI route was introduced, at that point of time, NRIs also were allowed to come through this QFI route, provided, of course, they don't use the NRI PIS route, under which they could even set up a company in which the NRIs could, you know, put in their monies, which could be registered as QFI, which can invest into India. So while this QFI route has now been clubbed with this FPI, it seems that they have, to a certain extent, then now, while foreign individuals can set up a company and can be registered as Category 3 and invest into India, it seems NRIs are not allowed to do that. So to that extent, at least they are put to a disadvantage vis-a-vis the foreign investors. So just moving on to other important, of course, aspects because of these changes that have been happening. The FPI regime just came a year back. It came into effect only in June last year, so it's almost 6 months. So a lot of players, the intermediaries, the investors, the ODI issuers, subscribers are still grappling with certain unanswered questions, which of course we hope that SEBI will come out whenever required. We have been having a dialogue with SEBI to try and get these answers. Moving on to the other topic of kind of a hedge funds, you know, Richie, if you can just kind of elaborate as to do you see any different trends into the hedge funds, the structuring or the investments?
Yeah, I think there are two observations I would like to make here, especially taking the cue from the NRI issue that you just brought out. So if, let's say, I was a hedge fund manager or a fund manager who's trying to sort of garner foreign investments into India, see, there are two tiers of fund managers. I would sort of put them in two different buckets. One is like a global general partner, like a global GP. They're raising funds at a very large scale from pension funds, endowments, providers of very extremely patient capital, which they deploy across different geographies, across different asset classes, etc. Whereas if you talk about another tier or another segment of fund manager who's only raising commitments for, let's say, India dedicated products, in those cases, NRIs tend to be a very extremely critical LP base for them, because NRIs are the ones who understand the Indian asset class far better or in a much more sophisticated manner, so to speak, than, let's say, any other investor who is only looking at India vis-a-vis other emerging markets, as opposed to, let's say, exposures to frontier markets. So NRIs tend to be providers of patient capital, so to speak, because they would understand that, okay, if there are ups and downs in the market, they can withstand it because they appreciate the asset class a bit more, as opposed to the cash flows which they may be seeing at a particular point in time. Now, a corollary or an effect of what we've just sort of gauged and understood is that if NRIs are to be limited to less than 49% of a sort of a investor base for a Category 3 FPI, an effect of this could be slightly, you know, ambiguous and slightly, you know, raising headaches for a fund manager. Because if I'm raising commitments, will I every time take a stock, okay, who all investors have already committed to my fund? Have I breached my 49% bandwidth for NRIs already or not? So let's say I approach few NRIs. One NRI investor already says, okay, I confirm my commitment to the fund, and with him, I have sort of closed my bandwidth of 49%. Then would I have to like then say no to the other NRI investor? That is number one. The other issue, even that global GPs could potentially face is, can they, in their subscription documents, make a statement that, okay, this is not open to investors which are of Indian origin, or this is not open to NRIs? Or if you are an NRI investor, contact the fund manager, in which case the fund manager will then take a call whether to accept their money or not. This, in my view, can potentially open a fund manager to a call of, let's say, acting in a discriminatory manner, so to speak. Like, can you on a racial basis or the basis of somebody's ethnicity say that, okay, I take your money or I cannot accept your money, etc. Sort of justifying the entire issue over, let's say, the view of a regulator, which may not even be articulated in black and white like Aditya indicated, can be very difficult sort of a discussion for a GP when he's talking to his fund investors. That was one. Second issue, what we have been seeing is more on the asset class side. We have been seeing more and more hedge fund managers slightly looking more towards the private market side as opposed to public market. There are, you know, illustrations replete across, you eventually saw Microsoft sort of IPO at an early in its life stage. What had happened is post its IPO, Microsoft made good returns for its investors. That's why people, you know, sort of take a view that, okay, I was an early Microsoft investor, so to speak. What has happened on the other hand is recently, you know, companies have delayed their IPO significantly. A lot of companies like, you know, Facebook IPO'd once it had gained valuations of 100 billion plus. Same is the story with Flipkart or in Uber. The example is Ripley. So what hedge fund managers have realized is that post the company's IPO'd in the public markets, there may not be too much of a, you know, value creation opportunity still left. So what they are doing is significantly they are participating in a private company sort of phase. So a company, because it IPO delays, the investor at large, the public at large, which essentially participates in a company only once it has IPO'd, they are missing out on these growth opportunities. Because the company, the real value creation is actually happening these days in a VC phase or in a Series B or a Series C sort of a scenario. So we see Tiger participating directly in a round where ideally a VC would have participated earlier. One of our hedge fund clients, you know, Stellview, they also invested $100 million in Flipkart. This is all in the private company sort of a phase as opposed to a public company play. So we see a lot of fund managers, you know, when we are doing the structuring exercises, we create sort of a private equity side pocket where a fund manager who already has some India exposure understands the asset class in India. They sort of raise commitments from their LP saying that, okay, my core competency, my track record is on the public market side. But at the same time, because of my presence in India and because I understand the asset class, allow me a side pocket where I can also take opportunistic calls on private equity side. So this is again, you know, sort of hinges back or goes back to what is your LP composition. If your LP composition is someone which is absolutely based on returns or something who wants his redemption rights, well, let's say he says, okay, I give you cash and like any other hedge fund, unless there are gates sort of provisions on the redemptions, you give me an exit as soon as I've given you notice within 45 days on a quarterly basis or some other, you know, periodic basis. As opposed to that, if you're talking on the private equity side pocket, you're talking more patient capital investors, those who have an appetite for India risk, because the private equity side pocket would then invest in illiquid opportunities which exist in the market. So accordingly, even the LP composition is now, the demography is changing, so to speak. What was earlier a classical hedge fund sort of an investor, you may see them, you know, also having some allocations for a private equity at the same time. So I think these are very interesting times for fund managers who are operating on the hedge fund side. Private equity VC space, of course, continues to be very interesting. You see a lot of multiple, you know, valuation increases, turns, etc. in matter of months. So I think these are exciting times. And as, you know, as you've all been reading and following, India story has been pretty much right up there. I think these are the two emerging trends I would say.
Sure. Thanks, Vijay. Aditya, maybe you want to add anything on this, especially on maybe HPL economics or some other trend or so.
Yeah, so I'll just make a few comments on hedge fund structures and really how the SBI regulations and, you know, the way it's been interpreted, more importantly, has impacted hedge fund structures. I think one very important thing, and this borrows from the comments that Richie had made earlier, is with respect to the participation of NRIs. Now, you know, as we understand that NRIs would tend to have a better idea of the Indian of Indian assets and would tend to have a larger appetite for Indian risk investments and risk in Indian investments. I think one thing that the FPI regulations and SEBI has really done is prevented an NRI manager from really having skin in the game. And, you know, those generally associated with the funds industry would have a very good idea about how important it is to for a manager to really demonstrate to his LPs that he has his money where his mouth is. I really put some commitment and commit some capital itself while making investments. I think that's something that's very important. Secondly, again, as Richie had indicated, redemptions has become very important, particularly in a funds context. You know, we spoke about how there was an issue with respect to NRI participation in Category 3 FPIs. But even if you take a Category 2 FPI, which has significant NRI participation, the fund manager is always going to be looking, you know, behind his back to ensure that he does not fall short of the broad-based criteria, because should that happen, he runs the risk of being recategorized as a Category 3 SPI, and then the restriction on NRI participation sort of kicks in again. But while these are points on structuring, I think I'd like to spend just a couple of minutes to discuss some of the recent things that we've seen in hedge fund economics. As with venture capital and private equity funds, we've seen a general shift towards from management fee or advisory fee towards carried interest. We've seen a similar shift in the hedge fund context from management fee towards performance fee, you know, to achieve alignment of interests between LPs and GPs. So today you have a number of managers who are willing to run very, very low management fee or negligible management fee, but who are willing to align their interests at the back end, that is, you know, at the time of calculation of incentive allocation or performance fee. In addition, you know, in order to ensure that their products are able to sell better, we've seen a lot of innovation among hedge funds as well. One of the things that we've seen is, you know, recent times, I think we've seen a number of hedge funds who are willing to adopt the soft hurdle prior to taking their incentive. And the other thing we've seen is that we've seen that even with the high watermark, we've seen variations where some fund managers are willing to offer the possibility of returns over the high watermark. That is the computation of their incentive or performance fee over the high watermark by adding an artificial layer of a benchmark and computing whether their performance goes over and above that benchmark. So these are some of the innovations that we've seen in terms of economics. And I think, you know, where hedge fund general partners has itself become something that's become very interesting to a lot of acquirers, and people are looking to acquire a stake in hedge fund hedge fund general partners. How they market the product, how they offer terms to the investors is also assuming a lot of importance.
Sure, no, I think I couldn't resist because Aditya said that, okay, if a manager were to put his own cash into the fund, you know, it's more like skin in the game. And he put it like, you know, putting your money where your mouth is. This reminds me of a very cruel anecdote which actually panned out. 2008-09, when Lehman Brothers sort of crashed after the global crisis, what happened, the entire tower that they have in New York was sort of, you know, sold off to buyers. The ground floor was taken up by a restaurant. So the restaurant which within the ground floor, which was previously Lehman Brothers building, the board outside said, put your mouth where your money was. You know, reminds of the cruel times that day.
Thank you. So it looks like very challenging and interesting time because of the changes that SEBI has been bringing into the FPI regulations. So a lot of different players, whether in India, you know, or outside India, have to kind of put their systems in place so far as the compliances are concerned, maybe because of these innovative trends into the hedge fund industry also. Looks like the GPs would be coming out with different structures over a period of time. So maybe I think with this, of course, we will open the session for any questions that the participants have. What we can do is let's start with any questions on the audience who are on phone first. And once they're done away with this, we can take the questions then from the participants who are present here.
Thank you very much. We will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question at this time, please press star and 1 on your touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and 2. Participants are requested to use only handset while asking a question. Anyone who wishes to ask a question at this time, please press star and 1 on your touchtone telephone. Participants who wish to ask a question, please press star and 1 now. The first question is from the line of Prashant Basikar from DSP BlackRock. Please go ahead.
Hi. I basically want to understand now with the new regulations coming in, effectively the erstwhile omnibus structures will no longer be applicable. So how are the industry players and the intermediaries planning to cope up with this? Because omnibus structure was quite helpful when a lot of these private banks did not want to expose the underlying clients. So what could be the possible ways this new situation?
Sure. So I think what we have seen is that clearly, like you indicated, omnibus accounts or omnibus structures where, let's say, just for everyone's the kind of omnibus we have seen, it's like there's a big giant pooled joint account of sorts which a bank would have opened. And let's say you have clients who put in money, take out money, etc. The entry and exit is at the client in the bank end. And the big joint account of sorts, which is the omnibus, is the investor that as a fund manager you would recognize as a participant to the fund. Now, the issue with the omnibus account and why it was pretty much prevalent was that, okay, the bank has its own private banking clients, so to speak, and they come and go out, whereas the product level interaction was done entirely by the bank. Now, clearly, as we have indicated now, the structures where you don't have a entity, so to speak, or the KYC requirements, or the, you know, who your end beneficial owners are, the tracking structures becoming difficult. Those structures have slightly been less favorable with SEBI's view. SEBI wants transparency. SEBI wants sort of de-layered structures. And accordingly, we have sort of started seeing emergence of a lot of companies or holding company formats as opposed to a omnibus account where you had a bank account of sorts directly for the investors to participate. You could have a two-layer or a single-layer company format where investors participate. You can, of course, have a loan note or other structure. But again, everything has to be viewed from regulations perspective. The loan note should not be perceived as a P-note in turn. If, let's say, the underlying is a share class or a security that you are holding as a sub-account or an FPI now, and on top of it, you have issued loan notes. So I think there are structures in the market. We have advice on a lot of structures which, you know, sort of abide by the bright line test put out by the law. But I think omnibus account, so to speak, by itself is no longer that much in prevalence.
Right. Thanks.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Pritesh Mazumdar from DSP BlackRock. Please go ahead.
Yeah. I want to understand, can, in case of fund seeks category 3 FPI registration, then would the DDP perform the UBO KYC of the fund or even the underlying investors?
No, so I think going by the kind of representations we have been seeing, you perform the test at the fund level, and the fund in turn for it to give those representations in turn sort of conducts an internal exercise. So to speak that, okay, is the representation that it is giving, so to speak, is it in a position to defend it? For it to defend the representation it is giving to the DDP, as an FPI, I would in turn do my own background check or homework indoors sort of an exercise. Now, how that is done, that is where the DDP sort of loses interface. Whatever information is needed is always available. But I think pretty much it is for the FPI to sort of manage its own home as opposed to DDP, you know, extracting data or information on that perspective. But of course, we can look at it on a case-by-case basis. As a DDP, you might want to probe further. Let's say if you are approached by a client, you know, willing to or intending to set up a category 2 FPI, and it's very close to 20 investors, then who those investors are, you may want to probe it further. Are they like friends, families, relatives, or employees of a particular group? If you are approached to set up a category 3 FPI and you see a lot of NRI participation, perhaps given the recent SEBI's view that the NRIs as a class should be limited to less than 49%, you might want to do an additional level of smell check or a smell test, so to speak, to that extent. But pretty much, I would leave it to the FPI to do their own homework as opposed to their interaction with the DDP's concern.
Sure. Just to add to what Richie has said, of course, while SEBI has laid down the guidelines as far as KYCs are concerned, they also basically refer to the PMLA regulations as far as the ultimate beneficial owners are concerned. So to that extent, depending on the percentage holding of the investors into those funds, there are certain guidelines that are laid down that if the investors go beyond a particular percentage, depending on what kind of an entity it is, the DDPs have to ask for the KYC of those ultimate beneficial owners.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. A reminder to our participants, to ask a question, please press star and one. We would like to remind our participants that you may press star and one to ask a question.
So maybe if there aren't any questions from the participants on phone, if anyone here present has any questions, maybe we will certainly take those. Yeah.
You had mentioned, and it is in the regulation, that the P-notes can be issued only against listed or to be listed securities. But there are other structures, like you said, loan notes. Can they be issued under unlisted securities like CPs? What is your view on that?
No. Well, it's... seems on the unlisted securities when you say, first of all, it falls out of the purview of the portfolio investment regime. So we are talking about a situation where is an investor.
CPs are permitted.
Oh, CPs you are saying, not the equity or so.
CPs.
Commercial papers. Well, it should be possible for this thing, but I really doubt if that would be reportable as far as the issuer is concerned.
It doesn't fall under the definition of ODI.
Absolutely. It won't fall under the definition of ODI, so from the issuer's perspective, it won't be reportable.
Yeah, it is not reportable, but can it be issued because, I mean, it is a gray area, I agree, and there's a lot of interest in Indian debt, so...
I think the definition of ODI only talks about listed or to be listed securities. So from SEBI's perspective, the FPI regulation, that ODI will not be captured if it's an unlisted commercial paper. So if it doesn't fall within listed or to be listed, it won't fall under the ODI for SEBI purposes.
So I think the basic test is it has to be listed or to be listed. So even when I said units of a mutual fund, what I meant just to clarify is those units, even if let's say you are under the infrastructure debt fund sort of a rule, where let's say you... SEBI allows you to have a sort of a commitment drawdown sort of model, but there is a laid out plan that as soon as the units get fully paid up, they are capable of being listed, or the SEBI MF regulations mandate that such units be listed. Then again, those sort of fall within the definition, okay, it is supposed to be listed. So you will have to sort of take a test across each of the underlying asset classes. Is this something which is already listed or to be listed? If not, then is it reportable or not, like the show added?
What about an IPO where the underlying is still not defined? Because only when you have an allotment would your underlying be defined. You do not know how much is the underlying at the time of the IPO.
Well, that is what SEBI meant, that when you are going under an IPO to issue the securities to be listed on the floor of the stock exchange, that's where then the FPI is holding those listed securities can have back-to-back ODIs or other issue ODIs. Which is what is meant by that.
And his position may be that point in time. Again, it will be outside the ODI definition. It is unless you can't issue units unless you know what's your underlying, right?
Yeah.
Maybe that can derail the definition again.
Yeah. Any question from you, sir?
As I watch and hear these regulations in general, it seems that the more regulations they are, the more questions there is often. And I want to know from all of you whether you feel that we as a country have more regulations than most developed countries, we are on par, or we have too few regulations in terms of sheer quantity. Secondly, in terms of the complications that we pose. And one question to Aditya, we're talking about hedge funds. Can you give me a sense of, in calendar year 2014, has there been an increase in hedge funds, either in amount or in the number of hedge funds, anything that you know? And what do you estimate, just as a gut feelers, what's going to increase in 2015 in the hedge funds that are specific to India?
So I think, just to take a second question, first with respect to, has there been an increase in the number of hedge funds for sure? There have definitely been a lot more hedge funds like taking Indian exposure. Existing hedge funds And you know, we saw quite a few of them ourselves, which had sort of stayed away from the Indian markets because they were shy of what might have happened in the public market. They started increasing their exposure. We saw, you know, for instance, there were a number of multi-class vehicles that started adding share classes so that, you know, additional investors could participate and start taking additional exposure. In 2015, I think it's going to be largely in line with what we saw in 2014. I think a lot of people are very buoyant position on the Indian economy, and particularly on how the public markets are going to perform. And I think to that extent, you will see a lot more hedge funds being set up and running operations within Indian focus.
What is the percentage growth in your estimate, the growth in 2014 calendar?
Percentage growth, I find it very hard to actually put a number.
I think our perception on the growth numbers would be based on the mandate that we are also advising on.
Yes.
Because clearly what is being reported is investments on portfolio segment.
Yes.
What is not being reported is the investor a hedge fund, or was it a global fund which suddenly had an India allocation? So clearly, you know, we would say that we clearly saw a 3x jump in the amount of hedge fund clients we have been advising. So going by seeing that, okay, we were the barometer, at least let that be the barometer for us to come into this question, we would see a 3x growth, number one. Number two, going for, you know, trends for the next year, this the current year, I would see more long short of strategies as opposed to long only. Clearly, there's a lot of volatility, a lot of headwinds coming this way. I would see a sort of an opportunistic call. Should I go long? Should I take a short bet on a particular strip? Those, again, back to vogue in 2015 as opposed to long only that, okay, I see the market going in a unidirectional move.
Just to briefly answer to your first question, of course, well, the regulations are there even in other countries also. As we know, in USA, the SEC has different regulations. The problem we see in India, which is quite distinct, is that in India, we have different regulators also, who have their own set of regulations. So for example, while you would have kind of a foreign investment regime, there is of course the policy laid down by the government of India, by DIPP, wherein certain investments, direct investments, goes to the FIPB. We have Reserve Bank of India being an apex bank monitoring all these investments. And on the other side, you have SEBI as the securities regulator. So while we say that all the portfolio investments are monitored by SEBI as a securities regulator, Reserve Bank of India still continues to monitor the NRI portfolio investment regime. The other problem we actually have seen in the recent past, of course, about a couple of years back, the government has all of a sudden added one restriction that any investor cannot invest more than 10% in any Indian company, either under the portfolio investment route or under the direct investment FDI route. Now, all these years, both these routes have been distinct and different. So all of a sudden, by bringing these restrictions, you know, there has been a lot of confusion that one entity then cannot invest if it is registered as an FII more than 10%, even under the FDI route also. So, you know, these confusions actually have been there because of maybe more regulators. So there has to be some kind of the regulators have to come together. And maybe it's only the time that one regulator actually now starts monitoring all the investments to that extent, which may relax this foreign investment regime.
I think to this mix, I will add one more factor. Maybe there is not that much liquidity and depth in the Indian markets. Even the Indian domestic investors, so to speak, has largely been dominated by the LICs and other sovereign wealth funds for India. The domestic or retail participants are still sort of lagging. So they would not want to overexpose the Indian capital markets. You know, if the entire market was open 100% to foreign investors, then the problem is there will be liquidity among the foreign investors. But if, let's say, somebody were to pump in cash and again take it out, the entire value could be lost for the Indian public, so to speak. And that could clearly destabilize the capital markets to an extent where it may not even recover. Then the entire, even the liquidity, even the foreign liquidity that you may be creating may even get lost. So I think you need some amount of hand-holding, even the current days, for the regulator to sort of look at.
I think I'll just add in a couple of sentences really, by indicating that it's not so much that we have too many regulations. Kishore mentioned, you know, the SEC is probably the most powerful regulator in the world, and it has a whole bunch of regulations itself. I think the real issue in India with respect to its regulators and with respect to its, you know, official authorities is that its regulations tend to clamp down or tend to restrict far more than it actually permits. You know, so rather than regulate, I think what the regulator really does or what the regulations that they pass really do is tend to restrict or prohibit certain conduct and certain action. Just to give you an example offhand, you know, alternative investment funds, for example, one of the first things that SEBI did after the AIF regulations were kicked in, and just before Category 3 AIFs really started kicking in, was to introduce a leverage restriction of 2x on the NAV. That was just an example, but I think this says a lot about SEBI's intention and the way SEBI looks at the regulatory framework.
That's a British legacy. Yeah. Regarding the CIS part of it, the CIS scheme, the collective investment scheme, are they changing this regulation? Have they changed? Because it has been quite a lot of problem in that area. As you see, all those CIS schemes have been at this point of time in debate in the parliament, if you really see. A list of 30, 40 people were there who had made all those investments. They are all stuck up. So, what is the change?
So, unless you want to add, I think we have primarily been advising clients more on the raising domain, where the entire framework was under the AIF regulations. Mm-hmm. Unlike the previous VCF regime, where venture capital funds, where you could opt in, opt out, or you can also operate on a unregulated structure model. We primarily have been advising clients who opt to set up an AIF as opposed to a collective investment scheme. So we have, of course, seen different models that work, they don't work, etc. But the entire CIS agenda is on a sort of on a different space altogether. We operate more, on the more regulated, where the intention is to pool investors, slightly more sophisticated, who understand that the ticket size is 1 crore, etc. So these are the sort of domains that we have been operating. Unless
clamped down heavily on CIS.
Right.
A lot of developers have been having these schemes where, you book a flat and then there is a buyback scheme within 18 months at a certain compounded return. So those schemes, SEBI has clamped down. There have been even some of the resort and hotel owners who have been doing timeshare arrangements where, as a customer, you can book certain room nights in, for next 3 years. And certain amount is collected, and if you don't use it, it is refunded at a certain premium. So SEBI has been looking at this because this is nothing but a way of pooling money without being regulated under any of the other regimes like PMS or alternative investment fund. And that's where they came out with this concept of 100 crore, that if it is more than 100 crore, then you need to come to us and register with us. So unless you get out of this four ingredients of CIS, which are there on profit sharing and, it should be in the control of the customers and not the manager. Unless you get out of this, you will fall under the CIS scheme and you will have to register with SEBI, and then penalties and all those things will follow. But you are right. I mean, we have been dealing with few clients who have got these notices from SEBI, and right now we are in the mode of responding to some of the queries.
Another question is in the NCD and CCD area. Now, in the issuance or fundraising through that mechanism, till that total amounts to 9.99, does it come under that thing if it is a convertible?
No. So, first of all, FPIs can do non-convertible debentures.
Mm-hmm.
CCD is more of an FDI instrument, foreign direct investment. So, for FDI, there is no limit unless there is a sectoral cap for that particular sector. 49%
or something like that.
It could be 49, 74 or 100%. So CCD gets counted towards equity for the purpose of FDI. NCD is more of an instrument for FPIs, listed NCD, where they invest. So the clubbing doesn't happen because of that. But unless it's again, it's a difficult thing because when FPI and FDI investments are clubbed, you cannot exceed 10%.
Yep.
But CCD, listed CCD concept is not there, at least in India, because again, FPI can only invest in listed or listed instrument post the new FPI regulation.
Right, and so
listed or to be listed. So CCD is typically, it won't be a listed instrument.
Right. Or if FDI is limited to 49%, after that, can an FII get into it?
Yes. So as long as the limit is not FPI plus FDI. If it's only FDI, so for example, there are certain prohibited sectors for FDI and prohibited sectors for FPI. Prohibited sectors for FDI are more than prohibited sectors for FPI. So for example, multi-brand retail is a sector where there are restrictions under FDI. But for FPI purposes, it's a sector which is open for investment. So even before this multi-brand opened up, Pantaloon and all these companies, right from 2000, they are having FII investment. So because multi-brand retail was not a prohibited sector for FII investments earlier. So if a sector has 49% FDI restriction, FII can still invest in that
sector. Does that not form a challenge in terms of takeover code?
But takeover code is an entirely different objective, right?
Because if you take the sum of it, there's a possibility of a takeover.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's a separate issue altogether. I mean, the objective
that
of
is more from the investor's
from
perspective,
right,
also.
Yeah.
Whether an investor with person acting in concert is trying to go, you know, beyond that particular limit, then only the takeover code would apply.
Right.
But if there are different investors to that extent, and under this restricted sector, as you said, you know, they still can invest up to 24%, which anyway is allowed.
Correct.
The only issue comes up that under these sectors, that when the Indian company wants to raise it beyond 24%, and where they are going to go to a regulator and seek an approval, where there would be issues from the regulators.
What about the control share part of it?
So that is all. So that's what I'm saying. One is exchange control, FPI, FDI or exchange control issue.
Right.
Control, PAC, all these are takeover code related issues.
Right.
So irrespective of whether it's FPI or FDI, if you are taking control in the company, or you know, you are breaching, let's say you are already above 25 in the listed company and you are acquiring more than 5% in one financial year, you will have to make an open offer to the shareholder.
I have one more question.
Sure. I think we'll take one more question for him.
Mauritius is a very popular route for entering into India. And an unregulated fund can come in with a regulated investment manager into category two. Now, in Mauritius, there is the self-managed fund concept, which is this self-managed fund can invest, can manage funds. So a self-managed fund can manage the portfolio of another fund. Now, can this be treated as a regulated investment manager? SEBI has not clarified this, but there is some interest in these sort of structures.
So I think a self-managed fund is adequately regulated because it would be set up in the format of a collective investment vehicle, which SEBI is very clear, only investment holding companies in its view is not regulated. Otherwise, self-regulated is perfectly fine.
Are there any other questions from any of the participants on phone?
No, sir. There are no questions.
Okay. So just one point that I want to make it to all the participants is that this today's DVD would be available on our knowledge site. And of course, we would also separately be sending a link to this to all. So to just conclude, as we have seen, SEBI has been giving kind of a challenging time, exciting time. To all the different players, the intermediaries, the overseas players, as also to, you know, general partners as to how to structure different kind of hedge fund structures to try and accommodate the NRIs and other set of investors as much as possible. So in case if anyone has any clarifications that is to be sought, they're most welcome to write to any of us. We'll be happy to answer those, and if required, if there are any policy related issues, we'll definitely take it up with the regulators. And with that, I thank you everyone for taking out their time late evening, and to all other participants in the US as well. Thank you very much, and have a good night and good day to all the US participants.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this conference call. Thank you for joining us. You may now disconnect your lines.